listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
That's right, I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and you're listening to Answers for the Family. This show was born of a desire to help guide parents and professionals to resources that they can help them, you know, resources that they will need when they face critical moments with their children. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and international parental abduction. Our experts will introduce you to specialized schools and treatment programs that can really help. Now, today I am very happy to have joining us as our special guests Sean Brooks, who's the executive director of Oxbow Academy, and Heather Green, who's a LCSW, and she is the clinical director of Oxbow. Oxbow is one of the few private residential treatment centers in the nation that's exclusive to teenage boys struggling with a variety of behavioral problems and sexual concerns. Sean and Heather will be discussing the rise of teenage porn addiction and the positive outcomes for adolescents in residential treatment today. We are fortunate also to have one of the founders of Oxbow, Steve Schultz. Everybody, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
Heather.
Yeah.
How are you?
Very good. How are you?
That's great. And now that I'm making some adjustments on the sound, it looks like I've got everybody right. And Sean, why don't you start off? Tell us a little bit about kind of the history of this problem and how the internet has caused it to escalate so quickly.
Okay, very good. Well, I've been working with adolescents in residential treatment for going on 16 years now, and at first we noticed a uptick in adolescents that were coming through with needs of treatment for sexual behavioral problems, probably around the late 1999, early 2000, and that has just continued to roll forward and get larger and larger. We opened our first treatment program for boys that were struggling with these issues in 2001, and have just continued to see this need being underserved, and more adolescent young men are in need of this treatment.
Go ahead. I was saying, Heather, what are some of the signs out there that either the parents or the professionals will see that may lead them to believe that that the problem is more of a sexual concern?
Well, I think a lot of our kids that come to us, I mean, what the parents are seeing is their child is isolating, spending a lot of time behind closed doors, on the internet, on the computer, being very secretive about that, locking their computer down to where only they can access, you know, their certain sites that they're going to. Also, parents, a lot of parents are really, really good about putting on passwords and safeguards on their own computers, and if the kids are spending inordinate amount of time and being successful and getting over the passwords. Credit card bills that are showing charges for things that are being purchased of a sexual nature, telephone bills, obviously the cable bills, and that after intervention by the family or family discussions, and that it continues or even escalates. I mean, these are just a few of the things that I think parents should be aware of.
Well, I think one of the things you just touched on was where the computer is, and this is sort of a pet peeve for me as well, and not just for porn reasons, but for a variety of reasons. You know, the parents need to have those things in a public area. If they have that in a public area, it's going to be much more difficult for the children to go on porn sites or any type of site, really.
I would agree with
that. Well, absolutely. I mean, I think computers in kids' individual bedrooms with full internet access, I think in this day and age is crazy. Not only for, you know, just them looking at pornographic sites, but a lot of kids now are being solicited for sexual purposes by, you know, predators on the internet, and there's a lot of dangers for them as well.
Well, Sean, well,
also not only in a public area, but also at location in that public area. So if you're in a family room or in a kitchen, it's important to have the screen facing out towards the room and not in towards the wall. But you also have devices that are beyond the computers and with the smartphones and with cell phones in general, where the parents really have to understand the technology in order to keep their kids safe.
Well, and one of the questions we have that's actually from a listener who I believe is a professional that says, how bad is the problem? In other words, how much of it is hype and how much of it is a real problem?
Well, from our standpoint, of course, we see the problem every single day. We would say that not every adolescent boy who views pornography is going to end up having sexual behavioral problems. However, every boy that we work with that has some sexual behavioral problems ends up, you know, has a porn addiction problem. One interesting thing as far as statistics go is between 1999 and 2002, the average user or the new video site viewer was about $18 million viewers a month, whereas between 2006 and 2008 that went up to 75 million. That's 75 million new viewers of pornography a month. So we see a huge increase in the amount of pornography that's being viewed. Now, who's viewing that pornography? Well, there's a 47% of those are adolescent males that are viewing that. That's a lot of young men that are getting
that's
on those sites.
Staggering.
So the problem is significant. I think the problem becomes more significant, especially with the young men that we work with, when parents are beginning to see behaviors that are more of a social nature. So, for example, the boys are beginning to demonstrate sexual behaviors outside the home and in a public place and beginning to lose control pretty much. And, you know, it's a problem for these young men as well. And Alan, you have a soundbite that might be really good to listen to a student talk about the problem that he was going through with regards to pornography. And that would be, I think it's Torment is the word.
Okay.
Okay. Soundbite.
All right. Yeah. Let's hear a little bit from. This is from a young man who has volunteered to speak a little bit about his problem and the torment that he's gone through.
I was in a state of torment. I knew I needed to stop. It was horrible. I needed to stop. I couldn't stop though. I didn't have enough self control to tell my parents or to get myself the help I needed.
Okay. Now, tell us a little bit about the need for psychosexual evaluation. In other words, at what point does a parent realize my child needs this? And Heather, can you help us with that?
Yeah, I think once you look at all of the signs and without and after intervention has taken place and the behavior continues despite the the intervention, then at that point you would, I would say, find a mental health professional that specializes in working with adolescents with sexual issues and possibly have them evaluated. And one of those evaluations is a psychosexual risk assessment, and that is, it's a combination between a psychological assessment as well as a sexual-specific tests, questionnaires, and it, talks about, the level of risk and just kind of also evaluates just the thinking patterns of the youth and to see if they're in normal, you know, thinking range or not, if they're sexually obsessed or, you know, or is it, you know, normal adolescent, you know, teen experimentation. Obviously, we don't want to take any adolescent in that's just, you know, does the regular experimentation that is typical for adolescent boys. I mean, but what we're seeing is obviously kids that are, I mean, this just becomes their whole world.
Well, and so from
the evaluation, then, you know, we can determine if there is a need for, you know, more dramatic interventions such as a residential treatment program or even outpatient therapy.
Well, Heather, I also
just want to add too that, you know, the kids that we're seeing that also are coming in with sexual issues, I mean, they're also dealing with other things too that intensify the problem, such as we're seeing kids with the lower IQs come in. We're seeing kids that are very socially awkward, have very poor self-esteem, are having communication problems in the family, friend problems, and are just, it's been a real easy way for them to escape from reality and the problems of just social interaction and to kind of hide away and go into their own, you know, virtual reality. Some of the kids that we have, and we've obviously they're in our setting and the pornography is being taken away from them. I mean, it really is, I mean, with some of them, I mean, it really looks like it's, I mean, they're going through physical, mental, emotional withdrawals from not having it or the fear or thought of not having it.
Well, Heather, it sounds like it's a very specialized area, even from a local psychologist or local psychiatrist standpoint. Is there a sort of a network or is there a group of people that specialize in this that Oxbow is in touch with? In other words, you know, from this standpoint, if a parent goes ahead and picks up the phone book or something and decides they're going to look, I've looked before, and I don't know that I see that as a specialty that's listed in there. So maybe what might be the best thing, and again, if Steve or if Sean, if you can give us the best way that they can get a hold of you, and if you can then refer them. So in other words, if you have a family right now that's listening and says, you know, I'm in St. Louis, Missouri, I feel like I have this problem with my child, I don't know who to contact in St. Louis, Missouri, are you able to give them somebody that's closer there or here in, you know, if it's here in Los Angeles?
Yeah, absolutely,
yep.
Alan. The best way to handle that is to actually go to our website. It's www.oxbowacademy.net. And on there, there's an assessment form. There's phone numbers that you can contact us, and we have admissions professionals that will assess with you what you're struggling with and make referrals out to places within your area.
Okay, that would be great. And Heather, I'm sorry, you were about to add to that?
Yes, we're also a member of ATSA, which is the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, and they also are a tremendous resource for finding professionals in the local area to do in you know, nationwide in terms of, you know, finding a psychologist that is familiar with a good psychosexual evaluation. Other resources are we are also members of NOJOS, which is an organization here in Utah of professionals that work with kids with sexual and non-sexual issues. And then you also have it's Safer Society Press that also provides a lot of just educational reading materials for parents, and that can be found at www.safersocietypress.org.
All right. Thank you. Sean, one of the things that shocked me as I read up on this was how early some of this starts. Talk to us a little bit about, how young some of these boys are.
Well, the average young man, the first time they come in contact with pornography, the average age is 11. And so they're gaining access to this stuff fairly easy. We've worked with many young men that they started even earlier than that. There's a soundbite I'd like you to play, Alan, and the young man talks about his experience, and we can add to that a little bit.
All right, and here we are again about a young man in his own words.
When I was about 8 years old, I was viewing pornography. I stumbled across pornography. I viewed it for a while. I viewed it for a couple of years, and then eventually led to a higher, I victimized sexually 6 different people over the course of about 6 to 8 months.
So this is not an uncommon story. This is not an uncommon event. A young man will hear the word pornography at school, or will hear, we've worked with a young man who actually heard the word pedophilia and was curious about what that meant.
So he Googled it.
So he Googled it, and sure enough was subject to images that really had a profound effect upon him. And to this day struggles a great deal in that area. And so the pornography industry doesn't make it hard for these kids to find it. It is simply a couple clicks away. And for me, I think people need to understand the nature of pornography. It's different now. It has changed. There used to be barriers of access to our children.
Mm-hmm.
And those barriers were simply that they're just, in order for a young person to obtain pornography or images, pornographic images, they would have to go through quite a bit in order to do that. It was not available to them unless someone else had it, and it was kind of a passed down type situation, where now it's a couple clicks away, and you virtually have a pornography peddler within your home as soon as you power up your computer. It's in your front room, it's right there, and it's 2 seconds away, literally. And parents need to understand that. With young children, it is very, very damaging, and can continue to be damaging throughout their entire adult life. It's tough for parents, especially parents that are working and trying to hold things together. And your school systems and everything else is so internet-based now that a young person has to get on.
Yep.
My young man that I'm a father of 2 boys and a little girl, and my little girl had to get on and do some research. And I'll tell you, it makes me really nervous. I have to stop what I'm doing and say, okay, let me help you with this, because one misspelled word could take her down a path and introduce her to things that I don't want her to see.
Well, and not only that, I mean, we have found that some of the people that own the porn sites are actually taking words that are very, very similar to school. So they want to take words that are close to the names of different schools. If there's a slight misspelling, as you've said, they've bought up all of those things so that, if somebody types the word, Lincoln Junior High incorrectly, it takes them to a porn site. Now, that's for an example. I don't know that one does. But
right. But
we have found that because I'm involved with, my boys are also, they're teenagers, and I'm involved at the school, and we have meetings on that where parents are reporting that their child was inadvertently taken to blah, 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 which now puts us in a position, I don't know about you and your kids, my kids have hours of homework every day, and any of it that has to be done on the computer, we now have to sit there with them.
Yep.
Or, as you said, or have a password. I mean, absolutely, there's a password on the computer so that the boys know they cannot go on without coming and saying, Dad, can you type in the password? But then we still have to sit there, maybe walk out of the room for, a couple of minutes if it's, it's in the living room and you walk through the kitchen or something like that. But you still have to keep it fairly close. And for those of us that are just one generation back, I mean, you know, the your access might be if you know, if your dad had a you know, a Playboy magazine under the mattress, you know, or maybe if your family got National Geographic, you know. Mm-hmm. that was the equivalent of what a teenage boy just going back one generation had. So I understand the huge issues that are going on out there right now, and really appreciate the fact that there are programs like yours that are now taking it seriously and looking at it as a major problem in itself.
Absolutely. You know, and we have to also understand that as parents, we're battling a multi-billion-dollar organization and company that has unlimited resources. And there's a reason why they're trying to gain access to our children and to sexual. And it's just not the porn industry, but I would say it's the media industry in general, is that there's a strong push for to sexualize our kids. And it's an ongoing battle. And I would say that as a parent, to be able to say, well, I've got a filter on my computer, that's kind of a dangerous position to put yourself in. I would like you to hit this.
Well, speaking of filters, yeah.
Yeah, let's hear that.
Let me go to that one. All right, we now have, again, this is a young man in his own words talking about his view of filters.
People who think that just because I have a filter, I'm good, is their child might be at the highest risk because they're not checking up on them.
Right, and I would say the best defense that a parent has is the relationship that they build with their child, and it's no longer something that you cannot talk about. You have to talk about sex, and you have to talk about problems with the internet earlier and earlier. You can't put it off, and you can't hope that somehow the school system is going to educate your son or daughter regarding these pitfalls that are out there. Parents have to gain relationships, strong relationships, through communication with their kids at an early age, early on, and actually talk about things that normally you'd wanted to wait until, you know, junior high. It is now something that has to come out in elementary school. And that it's the relationship that a parent has with their children that's going to be the greatest defense. It's not going to be a filter. It's not going to be the position of the computer in a central location, which is very important. But it's going to be a relationship of open communication, because it's not a matter of if your child views pornography or is subject to those images. It's when. Mm-hmm. And the important part of it is talking about it. The child needs to have a relationship where if they see an image that confuses them, or if they see something that they really are worried about, they can come and say, Mom and Dad, I saw this. This is what was going on. I was searching here, and this is what came up. And talk about the implications of those images so that really the child gains competencies in dealing with it.
Heather, how does this correlate with the communication with drugs? In other words, I think that parents over the last, you know, a couple of decades have been told, okay, you need to communicate, you know, the fact that your child is now going to be, you know, is going to be in a position to be offered drugs, or they're going to be in a position to see drugs. How does that correlate now with the porn?
Well, I think, you know, the difference between pornography and the drugs is that, you know, the substance abuse is still not as out in the open, and so I think to a large extent it's still easily hidden. But, you know, as far as pornography goes, I mean, you look at all, I mean, we're not just talking about internet stuff. I mean, our kids are now being exposed to it in video games. They have access, obviously, to inappropriate images on cell phones, sending pictures, receiving pictures, accessing the internet. You know, I'm seeing more billboards that are having naked images on them just on the road. And you've got TV, you've got commercials, you've got movies, magazines. I think that, kind of like Sean is saying, just the absolute open communication with, you know, healthy relationships and sex and sexuality, a lot of our kids that come to us, it's amazing to what extent they were seeking all of this sexual stimuli and hadn't had a single conversation with their parents about sex and sexuality and healthy relationships and their views of people their age and women and girls. And I mean, it's quite shocking. I mean, even when the kids are detected, oftentimes, you know, mom or dad have not sat down with them and said, hey, this is, you know, what's going on here? What's really the root cause of this? So I think it correlates a lot, but it's different in the sense that it really is everywhere. And yet, the kids are viewing it, looking at it, you know, and being exposed to it. But on the other hand, too, if they do cross the line, there are increasingly becoming very serious penalties, you know, for some of these kids, you know. And I don't remember what state it is, but, you know, an adolescent can now be charged with a sexual crime if he sends a picture of himself to another adolescent. You know, I mean, you're looking at lewdness possible mm-hmm. charges. You're looking at possible sending of child pornography, being in possession of child pornography. I mean, the consequences are pretty serious and viewed much more negatively and critically than, say, an adolescent that has a drug problem.
Well, I agree. Now, what age would you recommend? Now, for the parents out there, what age would you recommend that if the parents haven't already started having these conversations?
You know, it seems for a lot of our kids that right before puberty or puberty is when a lot of the issues are starting to happen. So their bodies are changing, they're becoming more social, whether they're being accepted or not. And at that time, according to the statistics, is when they are more likely to start to be exposed to that. I mean, and it doesn't, I mean, hurt to have start to introduce, you know, some of those conversations before then. But with a lot of our kids in therapy, they are in many cases reporting that around the 11 to 12, 13 year of age, hitting that, you know, puberty time period is when things started to go south.
Well, and I would agree, and that's why I was thinking probably 11, 12, something like that. You know,
uh-huh.
Yeah, about the time that girls don't have cooties anymore. Mm-hmm. But
yes,
but
exactly.
You know, but after listening to this soundbite of the boy that started at 8, that's what got me thinking. Wow, I don't know how early we should start.
I would say that when your child is able to punch a keyboard, you need to start talking about guidelines and boundaries and that some of the dangers of what they're doing. And my experience as a father is it seems like my children were born into technology. It seems like they picked it up amazingly quickly. So I have an 11-year-old daughter that can run circles around me on the computer. And she and my sons could do the same thing at a very, very young age. And so I would say I wouldn't put a age on it. I wouldn't say I'm not going to talk to my child about these issues until, you know, 11 or 12. I would say I'm going to watch my child and have an open communication. And as soon as my child starts bridging some of these topics is when I begin to talk to them about it. Because if the problem arises at 8, you don't want to wait till 11 to begin to
exactly.
Open communication with them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I would just like to add too. You know, if we go through life with our kids saying, "Hey, you can't do this and you can't do that," I mean, that's not a good thing either. But all of the things that I mentioned—the cell phones, the TV, the movies, magazines, video games, and even the internet—I think parents need to spend a lot of positive time with their children, you know, doing positive things, saying that, hey, you know, the internet can also be used for how to plan trips and vacations and how to shop, and you know, I mean, it's I am certainly, we are certainly not opposed to technology. We love it, but also spending time with the kids, showing them how all of these things can be used for positive reasons, I think is also very critical. But, well, and not to be afraid of it, and not that it's this, oh, this big no, you can't do that, because I don't think that's good either.
Well, and one of the things that you mentioned that actually reminded me of a case that we were involved in, and where the family said, well, I don't understand how this happened, because we had the computer in the front room, and you know, we were there when they were doing their homework, and we have a password on it. And then as I talked to the parent, and I found out the child has an iPhone. You know, and the parent didn't even think about the fact. I go, you can reach the same internet now with a smartphone, which means they can be sitting at their desk at school. They can be, anywhere outside the parent's view. So I think that, again, as you're saying, lots of communication. The parents need to stay actively involved, think about all of these things, or again, as Sean said, it isn't a matter of if. It's when.
Right. And not only just phones, but we've had students who were on their way into treatment and in the airport were accessing pornography with their gaming system. So if they have a handheld gaming system that has Wi-Fi capabilities, he was able to access pornography on the way to the treatment center for the help that he was getting, and the parents really were kind of oblivious. They thought, well, he's just playing a video game. Any electronic device has the capacity, especially now, to access the internet.
Yeah, in fact, and I found that out in regards to, they have what's called Xbox Live now, where the kids can be playing a game, but yet another person disguising themselves as another child can actually be playing the game with them, which then gives them access to them.
They can communicate with each other through voice. And they can talk, or they can do it through text, and they can talk while they're playing the gaming system.
Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure that before we run out of time that I also touch on some of the listeners' questions, because I really appreciate that they send them in. And one of them, and Steve, I'll put this one to you. It's a listener question that says, what type of students enter Oxbow Academy? And then it says, victims, comma, predators, or both? And again, I'm reading their words, so I'm not putting that tag on it.
Sure.
But obviously, if they have those words, then
sure,
I'll give you the opportunity to address it.
One of the things that we deal with all the time is that parents have a very sincere concern that they're going to have their son in with other, quote, perpetrators. And one of the things that we need to do to help parents understand is there's not an appropriate language around what we're dealing with now. Most of the language, such as perpetrator, offender, those kinds of things, come to us from the court system.
Right.
And so when we have parents come out and they visit Oxbow Academy, we take special care to have them be able to see and meet and talk to some of the kids that are there. And very soon they're able to realize that these are kids just like their kids. These are kids that have been caught up in some pretty serious things, but they have they're not the, quote, criminal-type kids that you see on MSNBC and some of the other types of programs out there. And so what we're dealing with are teenagers who are struggling with some sexual behavioral problems. They've been caught up in some things and can't seem to get cut loose from it. But there certainly is hope, and there certainly is help, and they're just they're kids like you would see in your own neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, basically we're talking about three different type of young men with different issues. We have young men that come in that have a significant pornography issue and are unable to break those habits or unable to break those addictions, and it's causing some significant problems for them. We have students that come in that have been in other programs for other issues. For example, they have been have some conduct disorder, or they've got some drug and alcohol issues, or they're just really struggling at home and in school. And while they were in a program, they acted out with other students, acted out consensually, but acted out nonetheless. And so the program was unable to help them, and so they're able to come to Oxbow. In the way that we manage them, it's a little bit different environment in the sense that our staff are all very trained, our facilities laid out exactly the way that it needs to be to optimize supervision. And then you have students that come in that have inappropriately touched others. And again, one other thing that we're dealing with in treatment is that it's rare to have a young man come in and everybody knows what's going on with him. Through the course of treatment and working with the therapist, there's a whole host of other things that are going on that parents were not aware of. Okay. And we have to be able to manage that. So you might have a student come in and say, look, all I've got is a real serious pornography issue. But through the course of treatment, we find out that it's quite a bit more significant than that.
Okay. And Heather, share with us a little bit. If this pornography addiction, let's say, is a secondary issue, What are some of the primary issues that these kids are dealing with?
You know, a lot of our kids are dealing with self-esteem, depression, anxiety, very significant issues within the family unit in terms of just lack of communication. Some are having significant learning struggles, which has, you know, impacted the school. And so our approach is, even though every young man is there for obviously a sexual issue, it's usually just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, our whole approach is very humanistic and holistic. I mean, the goal is to treat the whole child. Usually the sexual issue is symptomatic of non-sexual issues, we believe.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's pretty normal in regards to what I think a lot of us are running into. Now, I have another listener question, and let me pose this one again to Steve. Again, a listener question. It says, how long is the treatment process for teens struggling with these types of problems?
It's a very good question. Parents always are concerned about having their student come into a residential center and knowing about how long that's going to be or how long it's going to take.
Sure.
What we're finding is that the average is anywhere from 9 to 12 months. There are some outliers there. There are some students we've had that have been there longer, but it's based on the seriousness of the issues that they're dealing with and the family dynamics. So each of the students come in and they all are tested and receive an individualized treatment plan. So it's very individual for each family and each student.
Okay. And I have another listener question. And this is one that we get almost every time we have somebody in regards to a program. It says, what is the overall success rate of teenagers coming out of Oxbow or these types of treatments?
I think Heather would probably be the best.
Heather?
You know, right now Oxbow is so new. I mean, we've been open now for, oh my goodness, almost 2 years. And so we have not done any outcome studies with Oxbow. And even in the whole field of working of research with adolescents, it's still very limited. Our other program that we also have developed for kids with sexual issues, we are in the process right now of looking at our recidivism rates. But kids with sexual issues receiving specialized treatment, what information we do have, even though it's limited, is showing that recidivism is somewhere between 7% and 13% over follow-up periods of about 2 to 5 years. Now, that's recidivism for, say, kids with touching issues. As far as kids and treatment with pornography issues, I mean, that's still a very new issue, and not a lot of treatment programs that are specializing in just that. So, but when you look at the recidivism for kids with touching issues, I mean, it is very low with the research that we do have, lower than, you know, kids that are entering programs for substance abuse or other things, eating disorders. But because their sexual issues, you know, the severity of it and how serious this can be, you know, it's really hard for the public to believe that treatment isn't as effective as it's starting to seem to be.
Well, that, and
I know with our go ahead.
I say, and that brings me to one of my questions, is what about aftercare? How much aftercare are you recommending in these situations? And actually, who would be the best to answer this one?
Heather?
I will take that one. Aftercare is absolutely critical. And in fact, part of our in treatment, what we do is our kids, once they hit a certain level in treatment, we require that if they're going home, that they go on home passes anywhere from 1 to 2 times a month, so that we can set up safety plans, start to integrate them back into the family. They come back, we talk about risk factors, issues, they'll work on things, and then we, you know, send them back, and we allow for, obviously, lapses meaning, you know, they looked at pornography again, or they lied, or they stole something, or there's problems, you know, just with family communication. So we prepare them by doing the visits first, and then we follow the last phase of their treatment. We're helping the family either place them in other schools that could, you know, provide appropriate treatment, supervision, support, help. Some of our kids will go back into other therapeutic boarding schools. Some will go home. Some will go live with relatives. And so we also strongly recommend that our family finds a specialized clinician in their area that can continue to deal with the non-sexual issues, but also very openly address the sexual issues as well.
And
as far as time duration, if the clinician is specialized, then, you know, we would say anywhere from 3 to 6 months of outpatient therapy, but that would also be contingent upon the clinician as well and their recommendations.
Okay. What should the parents do in regards to the other siblings in the home? In other words, how do they talk to them and explain it to them in such a way so that you haven't caused a bigger problem now with that child when you bring this other child back into the home?
Well, if there are victims in the home, we go through what's called the victim clarification process, where we work with our student, and before we will allow our student to have any contact with the person that they victimized, we would require that they have a clinician and work on their issues, and then we would take direction from the victim's therapist in terms of, is reunification even possible? Do they recommend it or not? If that clinician feels like, yes, reunification is possible and important and good for the victim, then we will follow the lead of that therapist, meaning whether we have sessions, you know, before our guy, you know, goes home. So that could require they come to us, we go to them, we do it over the phone, and then slowly, you know, we may do some day passes with the family, and then we may do some overnights. So if our guy goes home, many things have had to have taken place if they have offended somebody that's in the home. And again, also at the comfort level and discretion of that the other person's therapist.
Steve?
Yeah, Heather, could you mention a little bit about the student who's gone back east and our therapist just left this week to go back and meet with that student and family. Maybe you could share a little about that process, Heather.
Yeah, we have an amazing, I mean, first of all, I just have to say our families that are coming to Oxbow are incredible. I mean, these families, so easily could have just kept things a secret, kept it under the rug, but have just been so courageous. We've had, you know, one family that when victims were revealed throughout their family, aunts, uncles, you know, the nieces and nephews, that, they opted to have the young man reveal names and information so that they could then get other children help that our young guy had victimized. And so this week, the clarification process will not be held with all of the victims that he has revealed, but our therapist has went back in order to help the families of the victims just deal with what has taken place, answer questions, and so they've actually set up, you know, various sessions and family meetings just for us to be able to help educate them.
I think that's incredible. Can one of you walk us through, we've got about 5 minutes, walk us through a typical day. I know one of the questions that I've gotten, it's usually after the fact, it's usually a parent that has emailed in a question and said, you know, what exactly is my child going to go through? How can I envision what's happening? So if you can sort of be the eyes and the ears of walking them through. Sean, can you do that for us?
Walking them through
a typical day.
Typical day at Oxbow.
Yeah, and I realize you said that it's a lot of it's individualized, but if there was a typical day, walk them through so the parents have an idea of what their child's going through.
Okay, well, at Oxbow, our culture is very treatment-oriented. We call it a therapeutic community, and so all of our students are involved very much in the therapeutic process with each other. Group treatment is extremely important. A basic day is a young man will get up and will have chores and responsibilities that he has around the facility. We'll do a morning group where they are planning out the day. Depending on the day, they could have, we keep our boys very active. They'll have exercise. They'll go to a rec center. They'll come back and prepare to meet with their therapist. They'll have individual sessions that they'll be preparing for. And then there's several psychoeducational groups that they're involved in. To name a few, you have healthy relationships, you have anger management, you have EGALA, which is our equine program where they work with horses. We're also involved in an athletic league. And again, one of our main emphasis residentially at Oxbow is to help the young man gain some legitimate competencies to pretty much wage war against the weaknesses that they are facing, and to gain competencies socially. They communicate a great deal. They're talking with each other all the time. They're holding each other accountable. They learn how to do that appropriately. Their education is they go to school from 3 until about 9 o'clock at night, so in the evenings they do their academics, and so during the day our therapists have full access to them during the day. It's very, very busy. We also are involved in a lot of experiential activities like camping and fishing. Being in Utah, that does aid us to be able to provide those type of experiences for them. I would also just, Alan, like to say that as far as parents go, in the world that we're raising our children in, it is very important that your child gets some, what I would say, competencies, some legitimate competencies, as far as, you know, being active and doing things and having aspects of their life that keep them busy, so that right. They're not able to isolate and they're not able to or kind of fall back into a fantasy world, but they really got to deal with their own lack of certain competencies in whatever area of their life. They've got to learn to do that anyway. Pornography is so evasive in the sense that it prevents the child from dealing with those inadequacies, whether it's self-esteem or anything like that, that are associated with it. That they need to gain those competencies so that when they're faced with that, they have other things that they're interested in that can help them not always revert back to, well, pornography, because when we talk to the boys, pornography does pay out. Pornography does provide a way for them to escape from the current situation that they're in and the way that they feel, and it does work. It's very negative and causes a great deal of problems, but it does work. So we have to have competitive factors in their lives that help them to, when faced with that temptation, to say, well, I'd rather go play ball. I'd rather go do this. I have these other interests that I'm involved in. I don't have the time. And so that we can get our children to adulthood, at least close right. to adulthood, where they have more of a choice in their life, and we kind of get them through this period, which is very difficult right now.
Right. And what I hear you saying is this isn't that much different than the reasons that you do things with them to keep them out of gangs, or the reasons that you do things with them to keep them off of drugs, or whatever it is that is their particular problem. And one of the things that makes me think of is that if this is an addiction, is there a problem with a replacement addiction afterwards? In other words, is there a situation in which some of these kids now are more susceptible to some of these other issues?
I think so.
Okay.
Absolutely, because especially if it goes unchecked and if it goes to a significant level where, like the young man that before said, he could not pull away from it. And there was some good advice that he had regarding that.
Well, and I'm going to close with that.
Okay. He did give some great advice to parents. And you cannot, the greatest power that a parent has is his relationship with his children, his or her child. You've got to build that relationship of communication where when your child comes home from school and says, hey, I learned a new word, and that word happens to be a bad word. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? We don't live in the world where we can say, well, don't worry about that right now. We have to sit down and take the time and say, let's talk about that.
Exactly.
Let's gain some really good communication, so when you're feeling frustrated or confused about the things that are coming into your life, we can talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Steve, again, I really appreciate you guys being here. We're starting to run out of time. Tell them again, how can they get a hold of you, either through the website or through a phone number?
The best way to get a hold of Oxbow Academy is through the website. Again, that's www.oxbowacademy.net, and that's got all the contact information there.
That's great. And if any of you are driving and you can't, you're not able to write that down, remember you can also send questions in to us at Answers for the Family. That's www.answers4thefamily.com. We love your comments. We really appreciate your questions. Heather, thank you so much for coming on. Is there any last words you would like to leave us with?
I just would say, you know, we love working with the kids. They come to us, obviously, with very serious issues, but there is an incredible amount of hope. The families that we work with are amazing. We love them. And I just really cannot stress that enough. I know that there's a lot of kids out there that are absolutely hurting over these issues, but there absolutely is hope and a whole team of people and professionals that love working with this population.
Great. Sean, Steve, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you,
Alan. Is there anything you would like to leave the parents or professionals with?
I would just support what Heather said, that there is a great deal of hope, and it is a scary topic. I've had a mother just recently say that she kind of wishes her son had a drug or alcohol problem, because at least then she could talk to people about it. I think we need to move into that range where people are more free and open to talk about this issue, because it is not going away. But that treatment does work, and that there is help available. And even though it is, like Heather said, a scary, scary thing, there is hope.
All right. Thank you. And listeners, I'm going to leave you with a wish from the same young man that has given us the sound bites up to this point. Have a great week.
What I wish my parents had said was properly explain how destructive pornography is. It's like, you're too young to understand this. It's bad. I think if they explained it a little more thorough, it would have helped. And what I would have wished for them to do is I would have liked for them to get rid of the computer for a little while, or to put some very strong blocks on it.